I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Alan Nathan. He's Professor Emeritus of Physics at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he will be giving a talk on the physics of baseball. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you are a nuclear physicist. How did you start studying the physics of baseball and even publishing scholarly articles about it?
Oh, it's an interesting story in itself. I like to tell people I've been a baseball fan even longer than I've been a physicist. But it was quite late in my career, about 12 years ago, that I actually got the idea that, you know, I could apply some of my knowledge of physics to the game of baseball itself. So it actually started off fairly innocuously enough. I gave a talk on the subject to a group of high school students, mostly to force myself to learn a little bit about it. What happened was a local reporter heard about the talk and wrote it up, and it made the next day's newspaper, and then people started calling me all over the place trying to ask me to give talks on it. And a few months later, I actually started doing some real research on it, and it sort of mushroomed from there.
One of the articles you wrote is about the physics of bats and the difference in performance between, for example, wooden bats and aluminum bats.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that for a moment. What's the difference? Why do some bats perform better than others?
Well, the big difference, most wood bats perform more or less the same. So there's very little to distinguish among wood bats. In fact, one of the very earliest pieces of work that I did was to show that a wood bat was already pretty well optimally designed. But aluminum bat is really very different. And to appreciate that difference, you have to sort of step through what happens when the ball and the bat meet. It's a very high-speed collision, and it's a very inefficient collision. So most of the so what has to happen is the ball has to come to a stop and then turn back around and go out the other way. And in the process of doing that, most of the energy of that ball goes into squashing that ball. And that's a very, very inefficient process. You could do the following very simple experiment. Drop a ball on a hard surface like the floor and watch how high it bounces. And it doesn't bounce very high compared with what you would get if you bounced a super ball. Super ball is a much more elastic kind of collision than a baseball. So a lot of energy gets lost. Now, when a ball hits a wooden bat, it's very much like a ball hitting the floor. There's not a lot of bounce to it. Most of the energy that goes into the batted ball comes from the bat itself, from the fact that the bat is moving. You don't get much from the ball. But with an aluminum bat, it's a little different because aluminum bat is a hollow object, not a solid object. And the thin wall of the aluminum bat itself can compress during the collision. So not all of the energy of the ball goes into compressing the ball, which is very inefficient. Some of it goes into compressing the wall of the bat. And that energy is very effectively returned back to the ball again. So all in all, it's a much more effective collision, much more efficient collision. So you get more bounce, okay, out of the collision, and the ball comes off the bat faster. It'll travel farther, and that's what I've described is sort of popularly called the trampoline effect. So you can imagine it's like the difference between jumping up and down on the floor versus jumping up and down on a trampoline. You get much more bounce when you jump off the trampoline. And that's sort of the fundamental difference between a wood bat and an aluminum bat.
So if you, I mean, as you've written, there's a balance between the pitcher and the batter that is thrown off when you have a bat that has more of a trampoline effect. I mean, if you had a bat with even more of a trampoline effect than an aluminum bat, the batter would hit the ball into the next city, and that would really change the game of baseball.
Right. That's exactly right. And that very fact is what leads many organizations to regulate the performance of non-wood bats. So in the major leagues and in the minor leagues, in professional baseball, they're restricted to using wood bats so that this doesn't become an issue. But in almost every other level of baseball, they're using non-wood bats. Sometimes they're not they're not restricted to using non-wood bats, but since non-wood bats perform better, that's what the bat of choice is. So in Little League, in high school, in college, semi-pro ball, they're all using non-wood bats. And the issue of the balance between the pitcher and the batter becomes important. And without regulating the performance of bats, you would have tremendously high-scoring games. In fact, the College World Series, I think it was in 1997 or 1998, the final game was almost like a football score. Balls were flying out of the park. And within a year or so of that, the NCAA instituted their first bat performance rules, which have evolved over the years. In fact, there's a new rule that just came out this year. And so that whole issue of keeping the game, maintaining the integrity of the game, maintaining the balance, the traditional balance between pitcher and batter, has led organizations such as the NCAA, such as the National Federation of High School, Little League, other organizations, to regulate the performance of bats. And actually, that's a very natural spot for a physicist to come in, and which is actually why I wrote the paper that I wrote. When you talk about regulating the performance, you have to define what you mean by performance. What does it mean when you talk about the performance of bat? What do you mean when you say one bat outperforms another bat? And then once you define what you mean, you have to figure out how to measure it and then how to go about regulating it. And then, so I've actually played some role in developing that whole process.
Are there also regulations on the length and diameter of bats?
There are. I don't remember what they are exactly. There is certainly a limit on the length. Usually that's not much of an issue because batters are generally pretty standard in what they use, 34-inch, 33, 32-inch bats for high school-type players. There are limits on the weight of a bat. I think there is a maximum that can be allowed, but more importantly, there's a minimum. So there is, in both high school and NCAA play, what is known as the -3 rule, meaning that the weight of the bat in ounces has to be at least as great as the length in inches -3. So it sounds like, for a physicist, those are kind of mixed units, which is a little weird. But so for what that means is a 34-inch bat has to weigh at least as much as 31 ounces. And the idea there is that the lighter you make the bat, the faster the batter is going to be able to swing the bat. It's not at all obvious, by the way, that being able to swing the bat, a lighter bat, faster necessarily means you're going to hit the ball harder. In fact, my belief is that you don't. That's sort of gets into the issue of corking a bat. Corking a wood bat is one illegal way to make the bat lighter, allowing you to get greater bat speed at the cost of having a less effective collision. You know, you can hit, all other things equal, you can hit a baseball harder with a heavier bat than with a lighter bat. But you can swing the lighter bat faster. So there's a trade-off there, and that trade-off generally does not work to the batter's advantage if you make the bat lighter.
Tell us what you mean by corking a bat.
Ah, okay. So corking a bat is the illegal act of taking a wood bat and drilling a hole into the barrel of the bat along the axis of the bat, drilling a hole in it about a foot deep, 12 inches deep, maybe an inch in diameter, okay, which makes the bat lighter by maybe a couple of ounces or so. And then what you do is you fill it, that cavity, with cork. The cork itself doesn't do anything other than disguise the fact that you've illegally modified this bat. So you fill it with cork, and then you sort of paint over it, and no one knows that you've done it unless you break the bat and they happen to see. And the idea there is that you get higher bat speed with a cork bat, but a less efficient collision. And this is actually one of the topics that I've studied. I'm going to actually discuss this a little bit in my talk tonight. You don't get a higher batted ball speed that way. What you do get is better bat quickness. Batters sometimes don't distinguish bat speed from bat quickness. Bat speed has to do with how fast the bat is moving at the time it hits the ball, and that's what matters most in terms of how fast the ball is going to come off the bat. But that quickness has to do with sort of the bat acceleration, how rapidly a batter gets it from, you know, near on his shoulder where he's first starting out into the batting zone. And a batter who has a quick bat can get around quicker on a fastball, can make adjustments to the swing more easily once the swing has already begun, things like that. So even though a batter using a cork bat might not necessarily hit the ball harder, he might and probably will make good contact more often. So if you're a singles or a doubles hitter as opposed to a home run hitter, corking a bat actually has a real advantage.
We're talking to Alan Nathan about the physics of baseball. Now, you, the physicist, have you helped to design the laboratories in which the performance of bats and the speed of balls and all of that stuff is scientifically tested?
I haven't been directly involved with the actual design of equipment myself. I know all the people doing it very, very well, and I collaborate with them on various studies. But that's more, I would say, of an engineering job than it is a physicist job. What I try to do is provide sort of the parameters of the design. You know, typically the way you test a bat is you fire a baseball out of a cannon at high speed onto the bat, and the ball bounces off the bat, and you measure the speed of the ball before it hits the bat, you measure the speed after it hits the bat, and the ratio of those is one measure of the performance of a bat. So what I've been involved with is trying to define, you know, how high a speed do you want to do the measurement at, what constitutes good measurements, how do you analyze the data, that sort of thing. The actual designing of equipment is not my forte as a physicist, and so I leave it to others to do that. So I tend to collaborate with those people quite a bit on experiments, but don't get involved directly with building the equipment myself.
And is it, I mean, you fire a baseball out of a cannon, are those speeds at which it's fired equivalent to what a pitcher's arm can produce?
Not exactly. What matters for the ball-bat collision is the relative speed between the ball and the bat. So if the ball is being pitched at 85 miles an hour and the bat is being swung at 70 miles an hour, it's the sum of those two that really matters for the collision if you want to test the bat. And that's 155 miles an hour. So they generally, the speeds then coming out of the cannon are much higher than a pitcher would throw the ball. So typically 135 to 140 miles an hour is fairly practical. You can do that in the laboratory fairly well. You could even go higher. Generally, they don't go a lot higher just because you end up denting and breaking the bats more often. So the specific answer to your question is that the balls are projected at the bat at a higher speed than a pitcher would throw it. It's because the bat is sitting there stationary. It's not,
exactly.
Yeah.
Now, what about the physics of the baseball itself? What standards and variables are involved with the ball?
Well, the things that matter about the ball are the size, and that's pretty well controlled. The weight, that's whatever it is, about 5.1 ounces. That's pretty much regulated. There is another important parameter, which is called the coefficient of restitution. That's the bounciness of the ball. So for a super ball, the coefficient of restitution is about equal to 1, meaning that when you drop a super ball from a certain height, it'll bounce up very close to the same height. So it's a very efficient collision. A baseball has a coefficient of restitution of about 0.5. Which means when you drop a baseball onto a hard surface, it actually comes up to only about 1/4 of its initial height, half squared. And so that's one of the parameters of a baseball that goes into into the manufacturing process. There are specifications at every level of play, whether it's NCAA baseball or Major League Baseball or whatever, there are specifications on how large or how small, what the range of that coefficient of restitution can be.
And you've also studied the effect of humidity on the baseball itself, and it's, you know, what I don't know the term you use, squishability and things like that.
Yeah, well, the squishability is simply another name for I call it the bounciness, or that's what this coefficient of restitution is. So there's actually an interesting problem that I got involved with in the last few months or so, in which this is a great example of a collaborative research. So first of all, we did experiments. This is Professor Lloyd Smith from Washington State University. He's one of the people I collaborate with quite a bit. He has built his bat and ball testing laboratory. The first thing we did was we measured the effect of humidity on the coefficient of restitution of a baseball. So when the ball is stored in a high humidity environment, it has less bounciness. It has a lower coefficient of restitution than it does if it's stored in a dry environment. And we measured that very, very carefully. And then the second part of the study was to try to figure out what the effect of storing a ball at a given humidity has on the number of home runs hit in a major league stadium, specifically in Coors Field, which is in Denver. And the reason why that's an interesting question is that beginning with the 2000, I believe it was three season, in Denver, they started storing the baseballs at in a humidor at 50% relative humidity, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas the typical on a summer day in the early evening in Denver, the relative humidity is probably something like 30%. So the balls, if they were stored just in the natural environment, would be stored at 30%. Instead, they stored them at 50%, and immediately they started seeing a fall in the number of home runs. Well, if you look through the 2010 season, comparing the number of home runs per game hit at Coors Field compared with what it was the preceding 7 years before they stored the ball in a humidor, there was about a 25% drop in the number of home runs, average number of home runs per game. And using the measurements that Lloyd Smith and I did on the effect of humidity on the coefficient of restitution, plus a little bit of physics, plus a little bit of statistical analysis, I actually calculated a number that was very, very close to that, which was truly amazing. I had no right to get it that close. But it just shows that physics is able to make predictions that are borne out. This was actually a post-diction as opposed to a prediction, given that the data already had been accumulated. But we were able to pretty much account for the drop in home runs that you saw in Denver. This topic had some real relevance because in Phoenix, they were considering also using a humidor. In Phoenix is even drier than Denver. The relative humidity there is more like 20%. And I concluded that if they were to store the ball at 50%, that there would be probably somewhere between a 35% and a 40% drop in the number of home runs, which is a pretty substantial number. And so that whole process is sort of on hold while they do additional studies in Phoenix.
But players find out about this and go on in a kind of anti-humidor movement?
there was some discussion last year that the Colorado Rockies in Denver, some players were complaining that the balls that were used when the visiting team came to bat were stored at a higher humidity than the balls that were used when the Rockies came to bat, giving the Rockies a natural advantage. So as far as I know, no one has been able to actually prove that, but Major League Baseball is sort of aware of that as a complaint and is supposedly monitoring the situation better this year. We'll see. I doubt that really happened.
But. Yeah, right. Now, do you play baseball yourself?
I don't play baseball so much anymore. I play softball. I've been playing pretty regularly. I took off about 10 years, when I was in my 50s, and beginning at age 60, I joined a senior softball team. So I still play. Yep. I don't play baseball. I haven't played baseball much since I was in high school, although I did go to a baseball fantasy camp 2 years ago, and that was a lot of fun.
A what?
A baseball fantasy camp.
What's that?
Every major league team has these so-called baseball fantasy camps. They usually take place in late January or early February before spring training starts for the teams. You go down to the Florida or Arizona, wherever they happen to have it, and it's a solid week of baseball where you have the uniforms, you have the full training facilities, and you're just flat out playing baseball for a full week. And yeah, I did that 2 years ago. That was definitely a lot of fun.
For how long have physicists like you been actually studying baseball in a scientific manner?
Well, the first account that I see of a physicist getting directly involved with kinds of measurements on baseballs and things like that was done by a fellow by the name of Lyman Briggs, who at the time was the director of the National Bureau of Standards in Washington. It's not called that anymore. It's called the National Institute of something and something. Science and Technology Standards and Techniques or something like that. It's called NIST now. That's the acronym. But it was called the National Bureau of Standards, or NBS. He was the director. During the war years, World War II years, he did some of the first measurements of the coefficient of restitution of a baseball. And then later on, in the 50s, did some measurements of the effect of spin on the movement, of a baseball, sort of answering the question, how much does a curveball curve? He did some of those early measurements, as well as measurements of the air resistance on a baseball. So I would say the 30s is the first time I know of someone doing something directly relevant to the game of baseball. Then there were a few other papers that were written in the 60s and 70s, but the pioneering work was done by Professor Robert Adair, who literally wrote the book on the subject. In 1990, I think it was published, he published a book called The Physics of Baseball, and that's the book that I read to first get involved doing that. So he was the guru of the physics of baseball for some number of years.
Now, we've just got about a minute left or so, but to what extent, if any, do professional baseball players themselves use the information that you have come up with?
Probably not very much. I think you have to sort of realize the whole purpose of that research. The purpose is curiosity driven, not in some sense outcome driven. We're not, by studying the physics of baseball, at least I'm giving you my own personal point of view, it's not necessarily to improve the game. The players themselves know how to play the game. They may not know the underlying physics of why they do what they do, but they certainly know what to do through many generations of trial and error or whatever. My goal in this is simply to understand and to put on a good, firm physics basis what the players already intuitively know.
Right, right.
And so I doubt that there's many instances where somebody, a player, would read anything that I've written or anything that Professor Adair has written and have a light bulb go off in their head and say, now I know I should swing the bat a little differently or pitch the ball a little differently. No, I doubt that happens.
Alan Nathan is Professor Emeritus of Physics at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.